and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Donald Trump's reported nomination of Governor Rick Perry to be his Secretary of Energy and speak with Luke Metzger, the founding director of Environment Texas, a statewide citizen-funded advocate for clean air, clean water, and open spaces. He joins us to discuss Rick Oops Perry, whose 2011 run for president crashed and burned when Perry couldn't remember the third of three government departments he wanted to abolish, which ironically happened to be the Department of Energy. We will look into the former Texas governor's record in Texas of being pro-coal, pro-oil, pro-fracking, and pro-nuclear waste, and assess what qualifications compared to his two predecessors Perry has, considering he has a bachelor's degree in animal sciences from Texas A&M, while one of Obama's last two energy secretaries was a professor of physics at MIT, and the other won the Nobel Prize in Physics. Then we'll speak with Jonathan Taplin, the founder and director emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at USC and author of the forthcoming book Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. He joins us to discuss his article at the New York Times, Forget AT&T, The Real Monopolies Are Google and Facebook, and how Stephen Bannon and the Trump campaign used Facebook to win the election by mining social media data, which they used to target different groups with different personal messages, while Clinton spent heavily on polling and advertising the same message to the same people. Then finally, we'll assess whether the Russian-Turkish planned ceasefire and evacuation of besieged civilians and fighters from Aleppo is real and workable, since the UN has warned that the Assad regime is committing atrocities in Aleppo, murdering civilians in their homes and on the streets. The English-language spokeswoman for the local coordination committees in Syria, Rafif Jujati, the founder and director of the Free Syria Foundation, joins us to discuss the lack of protection the majority of Syrians will have from the murderous Assad regime if the Russian-Iranian Assad forces recapture all of the regime's lost territory and succeed in winning the war for the Assads. And joining us now is Luke Metzger, who is the founding director of Environment Texas, a statewide citizen-funded advocate for clean air, clean water, and open spaces. He has played a key role in dozens of successful environmental campaigns and regularly testifies before the Texas legislature. Welcome to Background Briefing, Luke Metzger.
Great. Thank you. Good evening.
And Luke, am I accurate in assessing Governor Rick Perry's record in Texas of being pro-coal, pro-oil, pro-fracking, and pro-nuclear waste?
Unfortunately, you are. Texas, under Governor Perry, saw dramatic increases in dirty energy development, including new coal-fired power plants, some of the first in a couple of decades, and an enormous expansion of fracking, which came at significant environmental costs to Texas.
Well, extraordinarily, he, on Earth Day in 2006, he had a press conference, Perry, where he endorsed TXU Energy's plans to build 11 new coal plants, and he even made the ludicrous claim that air pollution would be reduced by having these coal-fired plants approved.
He did, and not only did he do that, but he also signed an executive order fast-tracking the permitting of these coal-fired power plants, so trying to circumvent the normal process by which these plants would be reviewed for their environmental impacts and would have adequate public comment. And then when, even under this, you know, fast-tracked process, when two administrative law judges recommended denial of the permit of one of the biggest of these coal plants, Rick Perry's Environmental Commission voted to approve it despite the strong evidence that these plants were not going to comply with clean air laws.
He also apparently promoted and permitted a low-level radioactive waste site in West Texas that was owned by his second-largest donor, Harold Simmons. And apparently, at least this is the expectation, that with Perry at the DOE, they'll expand this site to store even high-level radioactive waste, which is something that Perry's championed. So given that the Energy Department will write the rules determining where this waste can be stored, do you think Texas is going to be the home of deadly radionuclear waste in the future?
There's a strong chance of that. You know, we already are now accepting low-level radioactive waste from several states around the country, and that has put groundwater near the Ogallala Aquifer at risk, as well as potentially endangering people on the routes, you know, that the waste shipped. And there's been a strong lobbying effort for a number of years by a number of Texas high-level people and, you know, donors to Rick Perry's campaigns that have been campaigning for the expansion to now to accept some of this high-level radioactive waste. And so that could mean then we'd be seeing, you know, truckload after truckload of very dangerous radioactive material being shipped on our highways, going through our cities on their way to this nuke dump with great risk of accidents or spills or other contamination.
So the Department of Energy, nevertheless, is really more about nuclear weapons than anything else. It's 60% of its budget goes to the Energy Department's National Nuclear Security Administration, which oversees nuclear weapons and the nuclear stockpiles and runs nuclear proliferation and counterterrorism as well. Perry has absolutely no qualifications, right, in nuclear. His only academic background is a bachelor's degree in animal sciences from Texas A&M.
That's right. To my knowledge, he doesn't have any experience or expertise working with these kinds of materials. And so it definitely, you know, raises a number of red flags about whether he's the right man for this job, especially given just the, you know, significant expertise and educational backgrounds of his predecessors. This is a very high-stakes job, and you know, we would think we'd have somebody quite qualified for it, and it's unclear that Rick Perry is that man.
And of course, prior to becoming governor, from 2000 to 2015, Perry was the Texas Agricultural Commissioner. And again, I'm speaking with Luke Metzger, the founding director of Environment Texas, a statewide citizen-funded advocate for clean air, clean water, and open spaces. And he's played a key role in dozens of successful environmental campaigns and regularly testifies before the Texas legislature. So Perry, of course, is famous for his oops moment, which I mentioned in 2011 when he's running for president. He crashed and burned when he couldn't remember the third of the three government departments he wanted to abolish. And, of course, ironically, it happened to be the Department of Energy. Let's go to that clip to just remind our audience about who this doofus is who's about to head up the Department of Energy.
And I will tell you, it's three agencies of government when I get there that are gone. Commerce, education, and the, what's the third one there? Let's see.
You need five.
Oh, five.
Yeah,
okay. So five. Commerce, education, and
EPA?
EPA. There you go. No, okay.
Let's talk everything.
Seriously? Is EPA the one you were talking about? Or?
No, sir. We were talking about the agencies of government. EPA needs to be rebuilt.
But
there's
you
no doubt about
but
that.
But you can't name the third one?
The third agency of government, yeah. I would do away with the education, commerce, and let's see. I can't. The third. Sorry. Oops.
And that was a clip of Governor Rick Perry back in 2011 when he was running for president in the Republican presidential primaries, crashing and burning because he couldn't remember the third of three government departments he wanted to abolish. That killed his presidential hopes pretty much on the spot, didn't it, Luke?
Yes, it sure did. That, along with a few other things, led to the end of his run. But I think it's important not to underestimate him. You know, certainly he got a lot of attention, a lot of flack for not being the smartest. But I think that belies, you know, his impressive record here in Texas is just a political operator, somebody that knows how to kind of read the public, knows how to raise the money, knows how to line up powerful people around him. And so I think, you know, he could be quite dangerous in that role. So it's important not to underestimate his abilities.
Well, wasn't he a pay-for-play governor, essentially? I mean, that's his skill, isn't he? Raising money and doing what the big money people tell him to do.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. Yes, and what I mean is he's skilled at that. He had received millions of dollars in campaign contributions from the big oil companies, from the coal companies, from the radioactive waste companies, and he then turned that that money and used his power to act on their behalf, quite frequently at the expense of public health and the environment. So, for example, the Environmental Agency, while at the same time he was fighting the Environmental Protection Agency at the federal level, saying they were overreaching and insisting on the state's rights to run our own environmental agency, he was gutting our programs here in the state. So he oversaw, during his time, hundreds of people were laid off, so weakening the power of the state environmental agency. And the state auditor of Texas reviewed their enforcement programs and found that, surprised, they weren't effectively enforcing the laws, that big polluters were routinely getting off the hook for violations. And so that's definitely our fear, is that he'll take that same approach, putting the interests of the powerful and the big polluters ahead of what, science tells us is the right approach, and what, just basic concern for the environment and health tells us is the right course of action.
Well, inasmuch as the oops moment in 2011 killed his chances back in that race, that didn't stop him from joining the 2015 race, but he dropped out in 2015, did he not? Fairly early.
He did, yeah. He was one of the first to exit the race, I believe. So didn't make much of that, and so then went from there to performing on Dancing with the Stars, and now going to running the nation's nuclear programs.
And of course, he—I don't mean to laugh, because it is a serious business, particularly when you're dealing with nuclear weapons, and you certainly can't have an oops moment with nuclear weapons. But this is what I was curious about. When he was campaigning for the nomination in 2015, he called Donald Trump a barking carnival act and a cancer on conservatism. But yet he campaigned energetically for Trump in this election season. What happened there, do you think?
Well, generally he's been pretty good at reading the political wind. So, for example, he can afford saw the rise of the Tea Party and very quickly kind of embraced it in 2010 and used it to fight off a primary challenge of by then Senator, U.S. Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison, and really kind of cemented his right-wing standing from there. And I think, his reading at the time was that, Donald Trump is this, flash in the pan and, clearly can't go anywhere, and that, the right approach would be to take this, uniquely principled stand, which he was certainly not known for. And unfortunately, he was wrong on that time, and Donald Trump did survive. But he's quick to evolve and reshape himself to meet whatever the political winds are. And so I think that's why he was quick to then change his tune and embrace Donald Trump. I think that makes him quite dangerous.
But to be fair, there's some good things he did. In his tenure as governor, Perry helped create the Texas renewable energy boom by signing into law an infrastructure project that built nearly $7 billion in transmission lines to carry wind power into Texas cities, which also created tens of thousands of good-paying jobs. So that is certainly something to be noted.
It is, and we hope that he will take that lesson and the experience that presided over to that federal level and do take some steps to promote wind and solar, and not just, the coal and the oil and gas, which I think was largely, the area that he focused on. But yes, we do have to give him some credit. There, without the transmission expansion, Texas wouldn't be the national leader in wind power, surpassing California. Definitely we give credit where credit is due.
Well, just in closing, you say that he's always had, sucked up to, sidled up, whatever you want to say, to big money. And his second largest donor is Harold Simmons, who's got the nuclear waste depository that may become a recipient of high-level waste in the next 4 years. What is the relationship with, say, Simmons? Is he one of Trump's guys as well? I'm trying to figure out why he got the job.
Yeah, well, Simmons is passed away about a year or two ago, but he had been, you know, one of the largest donors to the Republican Party, and a lot of, you know, the people that worked still with the company with Waste Control Specialists have a lot of influence within the Republican Party nationally. And I wouldn't be surprised if that had an influence in the Trump's being appointed, or excuse me, Trump Perry being appointed by Trump.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Luke Metzger.
Well, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Luke Metzger, who is the founding director of Environment Texas, a statewide citizen-funded advocate for clean air, clean water, and open spaces. He has played a key role in dozens of successful environmental campaigns and regularly testifies before the Texas legislature. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how Stephen Bannon and the Trump campaign used Facebook to win the election. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jonathan Taplin, the founder and director emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California, where he specializes in international communication and digital media entertainment. He began his entertainment career as tour manager for Bob Dylan and the band and produced Martin Scorsese's first feature film, Mean Streets. He went on to produce television documentaries, including The Prize and Cadillac Desert for PBS, and 12 feature films, including The Last Waltz, Under Fire, and To Die For. His latest book is Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. And he has an op-ed at the New York Times, Forget AT&T, the real monopolies are Google and Facebook. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Taplin.
Pleasure to be here.
And, Jonathan, of course, a lot is being made of the choice of Secretary of State, the head of Exxon, Rex Tillerson, and Exxon being a powerful multinational corporation. But my understanding is that their market capitalization pales beside that of Google's.
Yeah, I mean, Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, and Microsoft are the largest American corporations. ExxonMobil comes in sixth. So it's really nothing, you know, and quite frankly, Google's market cap is almost twice what ExxonMobil's is. So the real giants in American business are these digital monopolies.
And how come it goes under the radar? I mean, Exxon is considered a kind of behemoth. A lot of people are very skeptical, if not alarmed, at the choice of Rex Tillerson as the Secretary of State. But meanwhile, these other massive monopolies, as you say, twice as big as Exxon, don't get a lot of attention.
Well, they've managed to cover themselves in a kind of greenwashing. You know, Google's motto was don't be evil. And so the assumption was that they would always do the right thing. And because it has the appearance of being free to you, the consumer, people don't really think much about it. Of course, it's not free, and it's a giant advertising monopoly which is using surveillance, i.e. all the data that you have on your computer and everywhere, where you travel, everything that's on your phone, and all of that surveillance data is sold to marketers. And there's a cost for that, but people don't really understand that. And as someone once said, if you're getting it for free, you're not the consumer, you're the product. And then that's exactly what the situation is.
In other words, they've monetized you and me, but we get nothing out of it.
Well, you give them all your data, much more than the NSA ever got from you, and in return for being able to search or for be able to put your vacation post pictures up on Facebook for your friends, and they in turn sell it at an extreme premium because they are what economists call rent takers. So they have a very specific monopoly over, in Facebook's case, 1.8 billion people, which they have giant amounts of data about them, and they sell the rights for advertisers to get to that public on an extraordinarily targeted basis for a large premium. It's known in economics as a rent. And that is exactly what Google does in when you search for something.
Well, I've been trying to cover what happened in this election, and I don't believe that journalists have really gotten to the nub of what happened here, and apart from the deficiencies of the Hillary Clinton campaign. It does seem that Stephen Bannon, who Donald Trump chose as his chief strategist, actually is quite a clever strategist. And he has a company, he's on the board of Cambridge Analytica, that does data mining on social media, in particular Facebook. The Republicans went after Facebook early with this bogus claim that they were biased in their human curation of the news. And one of the things that buttress your point about the power of these monopolies, two-thirds of the American people get their news from Facebook. That's a massive, massive power and influence they have. So the Republicans saw that, and the Trump people saw that right away. They came out with this bogus idea that they were biased. They rolled Zuckerberg into getting rid of human curation and then putting in algorithms. And Bannon and company were ready to game the algorithms with fake news. And I think to this day, we don't know how much clever they were, that they didn't spend a lot of money on this campaign. But by targeting Facebook, they got the very personal information, not the sort of information the pollsters get, but they got really deep information about who they were targeting, and they were able to target all kinds of micro groups with different bits of information, some of it contradictory, a lot of it false.
Well, not only could they target their own potential supporters, but they were also able to suppress voters strongly. For instance, one of the tactics they used was to target young black voters and push out information that Hillary had called young black men super predators. And that was targeted very specifically to urban districts that they knew where if they could turn people off from Hillary and suppress the vote, that wouldn't come out and she wouldn't get to the levels that Obama was able to get to, which was obviously in states like Michigan and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin made the difference. So it was extraordinarily successful strategy. And needless to say, as we now know, Trump spent less than half of what Hillary spent. But most of that money was spent on Facebook. And it was spent on this very targeted, micro-targeting thing. And it's needless to say the exact same thing what advertisers are doing. If I want to find women who are 30 years old who drink bourbon and drive Chevy trucks in Nashville, Tennessee, I can do that on Facebook. You know, so I mean, that's the kind of world that we're going to live in. And you know, as some people have pointed out, eventually this could lead to a world where, you know, why have elections? We'll just poll Facebook and figure out what people really want, you know, and this is the direction that Trump and Bannon are taking us.
Let's talk a bit about your op-ed in Tuesday's New York Times, Jonathan Taplin. Basically, what you're telling us is that our focus on this merger with AT&T is off the mark. They're picayune players compared to...
They're minor players. I mean, if you think about we always think of the Walt Disney Corporation as the largest media company in the world because it owns ABC TV and ESPN and all this stuff. But Google is twice the size of Walt Disney in terms of the amount of money it takes in from advertisers every year. So, I mean, this notion that somehow, you know, that the merger of AT&T and Time Warner is going to somehow radically change the media landscape. It's nonsense compared to the power that Facebook and Google have in terms of consumers. Let's think about Time Warner and AT&T. In total, they will have about maybe 35 million subscribers on the total of AT&T's and DirecTV's and all those networks. And you know, Facebook has 1.8 billion subscribers, and Google has 1.4 billion users. So, I mean, the scale is just not even comparable. Never mind the fact that Google, you know, makes far more money than any of these things. And, by the way, even worse is, like, one of Google's subsidiaries, YouTube, has completely eviscerated the music business. YouTube has 55% market share in streaming music. And that is just pure audio files. 55% of all the streamed music comes through YouTube, and yet they pay only 11% of the revenue into the music business. So they're essentially free riders, and this is the basis of their monopolies.
Well, in terms of the area that I'm interested in, which is the news and media, I mean, I take it you're not necessarily endorsing this merger between AT&T and Time Warner.
I'm not endorsing anything. In fact, I think all these mergers. Look, the antitrust division of the Justice Department has been asleep since the Reagan era, and this is not just a Republican issue. It's a Democratic issue, too. I mean, Bill Clinton was terrible on antitrust. He allowed all these media mergers to take place. And, you know, I mean, essentially, the tools that were put in place in the Clinton era made it possible for Google and Facebook to do what they do, because they passed an internet media law called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act that gave them total safe harbor to essentially do anything they want on the internet, as long as, you know, if consumers complain, then they have to take it down. But it's up to the, you know, responsibility of the rights holder to go and police YouTube or Facebook and get their content off it when it's put up illegally. So I'm not averse to anything. All I'm saying is that we've had a libertarian driven push against antitrust. Peter Thiel, who is convening a group of tech billionaires today in Trump Tower, says that monopoly is the only way for anyone to make money in this current age. He thinks monopoly is a good thing. And I'm just saying monopoly is not a good thing. Monopoly leads to political power, which leads to all the small players being pushed out.
And the main casualties have been the artists themselves.
Not only the artists, journalists.
Well, yeah, you know, I was about to get to that.
Half the number of working journalists are working today as we're working in 2004. Half.
Right. Well,
the number of people working in journalism has dropped by half. The amount of revenue flowing to newspapers has gone from about $68 billion down to $23 billion in just 10 years.
Well, I was going to bring up the case that you mentioned in your article in the New York Times, Jonathan Taplin, Forget AT&T, the Real Monopolies Are Google and Facebook. The fact that The Guardian, and I interview people from The Guardian a lot, and it's one of the sources that I rely on, you know, they're asking for money from their listeners now, saying, for God's sake, help us out. They haven't put a wall up like Murdoch did with The Wall Street Journal, a paywall, but they're trying to survive. They're cutting all their journalists around the world. They do a hell of a good job. And the former head of editor of The Guardian estimated that Facebook sucked up 27 million of the paper's projected digital advertising revenue in the last year by essentially keeping Guardian readers on Facebook rather than linking them to The Guardian site. So
exactly.
This is what they do. They just take stuff, make money
and,
out of it.
And by the way, when Facebook decides it's going to change its magic algorithm, and then all of a sudden, you know, they don't tell The Guardian or The New York Times that they're doing that, and so all of a sudden things disappear. I don't see those posts anymore because they decide that I'd rather see the cat photos from my Aunt B, you know, than I'd rather see The Guardian. I mean, it's all a black box. And you know, this whole notion that somehow these brilliant magical algorithms are going to make our life better is a techno-determinist fantasy.
Well, then, broaden this out a little bit then, which I believe you've done in your new book, which is titled Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. My understanding is that that what your thesis is that the Internet that we have today is not what we should have had and could have had.
Right. So the original inventors of the Internet, all of whom donated the code that they wrote for free to ARPANET, which was this, you know, funded by the Defense Department. So, you know, all the libertarians neglect the fact that the United States government built the Internet. And the original idea of it was this going to be this very decentralized democratic medium. And what we ended up with is a completely centralized medium in which three companies, Amazon, Google, and Facebook, control most of the traffic that flows over the Internet, control most of the data that flows from the Internet, and control most of the revenue. And that revenue no longer flows to the content owners, no longer flows to the journalists, no longer flows to the photographers, to the musicians, to the cinema makers. And it stays in these companies that are so profitable that they don't even know what to do with their money. Google has $82 billion of cash sitting in the bank. $82 billion. They have no idea how to spend money that they have. So, I mean, these are businesses that no one has seen businesses as profitable as these. And yet we think as if this is some kind of free gift from God and it has no consequences. Of course it has consequences. And the election was the true test. Everyone has said Trump could not have been elected if it hadn't been for Facebook. It's just flat out that simple.
So forget about the Russians.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
No. And you know, quite frankly, you know, there's this wonderful story of these Macedonian kids who are like 17, have no idea about American politics, but are making, you know, $5,000, $10,000 a week off of Google AdSense ads with their fake news that they post on Facebook. To all the suckers in Trump land.
Well, of course, that wasn't specifically related to that, but what happened, of course, as we all know, was this fellow from North Carolina showed up with a bunch of guns and shot up a pizza place in Washington, D.C. with an assault rifle because he thought he was freeing a bunch of children who were sex slaves in a ring that was run by Hillary Clinton. I mean, you're a producer of a number of Hollywood movies, Jonathan Taplin. If some writer came up with a script like that, you'd probably throw him out of the room, wouldn't you?
Totally. You know, and you know what's so astonishing to me? BuzzFeed came up with this survey in which it turned out that the top fake news stories got more play on Facebook than the top stories from the Washington Post, the New York Times, CBS, CNN, and MSNBC combined.
Well, is there anything that can be done? I mean,
I propose in the book several steps, one of which is to break up some of these monopolies. You know, I mean, Facebook could have never, in a rational world, bought both WhatsApp, Instagram, and Messenger. In other words, Facebook is not just Facebook. It's the three of the other largest online portals. Google could have never bought, you know, the ad, right, various ad pods that it's bought.
And YouTube as well, yeah.
Yeah. So one thing is maybe just to break the up. The second thing that I've suggested is that it could be that we have to go back to what we did with AT&T in the 50s, which is, okay, if Google is a monopoly and it's what economists call a natural monopoly, meaning that it's so dominant that there's no point in trying to start a competitor, then maybe Google has to do what AT&T had to do in the 50s, which was turn all its intellectual property over to the rest of the country for free. In other words, Bell Labs, which was the AT&T Research and Development Group, had to license everything that it did to everybody for free in return for them having a monopoly. So out of that flowed the semiconductor patents, which then led to Texas Instruments, Intel, all these other companies, Fairchild Semiconductor. Out of the cellular patents came Motorola and Nokia. Out of the solar patents came all the new solar companies. Out of the satellite patents that AT&T had came ComSat and all the satellite companies. So maybe, you know, if Google had to license all its intellectual property for free, then maybe we could have a more level playing field. There are other suggestions in the book have to do with municipal broadband, you know, lots of ways in which cities can begin to move against these giant monopolies. And, you know, I'm not completely depressed that there's nothing we can do about it. I think if we return to the kind of era that Teddy Roosevelt had, in which large corporations need to be supervised by the government, then maybe we can have a kind of progressive progress era again.
Well, just in closing, the country that invented the internet has the worst broadband in the world. The national average is 9 megabits per second. When you know, it's a gigabyte in Japan, South Korea, even in France.
But if you go down to Chattanooga, Tennessee, where they're the local municipal broadband utility owned by the town runs 10 gigabits per second.
Wow. You
know, So, you know, obviously Comcast and AT&T are suing them to try and stop them from being successful. But, you know, it is possible for us to have competition with these giants.
Well, Jonathan Tapner, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Tapner, who's the founder and director emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California, where he specializes in international communication and digital media entertainment. He began his entertainment career as tour manager for Bob Dylan and the band and produced Martin Scorsese's first film, Mean Streets. He went on to produce television documentaries, including The Prize and Cadillac Desert for PBS, and 12 feature films, including The Last Waltz, Under Fire, and To Die For. His latest book is Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon cornered culture and undermined democracy. And he has an op-ed at the New York Times, Forget AT&T, the real monopolies are Google and Facebook. We're going to take a brief station break and back assessing whether the Russian-Turkish planned ceasefire and evacuation of besieged civilians and fighters from Aleppo is real and workable.
تني بجوز عيونه الاسمار الحنطاوي
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Rafif Jujati, who's the founder and director of Free Syria Foundation. She's also the English spokeswoman for the Local Coordination Committees in Syria, a grassroots network designed to align the activities of pro-democracy Syrians in each of the countries. country's 14 governorates. Rafif frequently travels to the Middle East and Syria and coordinates with other activists to take action and inform the public about events in Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rafif Jujati.
Thank you, Ian.
And it looks as though a deal has been worked out between Turkey and Russia to provide safe passage for the civilians and the fighters that are under siege in Aleppo. Earlier, a spokesman for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Rupert Colville, said that he'd been told about at least 82 civilians, including women and children, were shot in their homes or on the streets on Monday by the Assad regime as they closed the noose. And at the United Nations yesterday, the Secretary General said, "We have collectively failed the people of Syria," and U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Samantha Power, just ripped into the Assad regime and Russia and Iran, saying, "Are you truly incapable of shame? Is there nothing you will not lie about? Your barrel bombs and airstrikes, it's your noose. Three member states of the U.N. are contributing to a noose around civilians." So has that noose been loosened a little?
Not in the slightest. The report of 82 civilians being killed either in their homes or on the street is actually underreported. We're trying to get the latest number. It's almost impossible to verify the actual death toll, but I would say that it's in the hundreds. People are being rounded up. They're being executed both in their homes and on the streets. Those people who've been promised safe passage are being shot at. And so this is anything but a deal. It's anything but a real ceasefire. And while I appreciate the words of Samantha Power and agree with them, I do have to say this is too little, too late. Those words should have been coming out of the U.S. administration a long time ago. And it's not time for condemnations and insults. It's time for action.
So what then do you make of this deal that's been negotiated between Turkey and Russia for this safe passage and a ceasefire? How real is it?
Well, we won't know until tomorrow. From what I understand, the details are not yet clear on the terms of this ceasefire. But essentially, the terms, as we know them now, are that fighting factions and their families can leave by early tomorrow morning, and they're being assured of safe passage. But what we're seeing is that people, regular civilians, not fighters, nobody with weapons, up to 35,000 people have been trying to flee, and many of them are getting shot in the street. So I don't know what tomorrow will bring. I don't know what new horrors we'll see in the morning in Syria, and that's just a few hours away. So we won't really know any more until tomorrow.
Well, but prior to this, there was an agreement that the Assad regime came up with to evacuate some people from the siege of Aleppo. And my understanding is that all the men were taken out of the convoys coming out, and they've just simply disappeared. So what happened in the earlier instance, and is that true, that you know, people were allowed out, but the men and boys were grabbed and have since disappeared?
So what my understanding is exactly what you've just said. Some civilians were allowed out, but we don't necessarily know their fate. Among those civilians, men and boys were rounded up and have been disappeared. This isn't new with the Assad regime. The regime's been doing this for years, not just with the beginning of the Syrian revolution, but back in Assad the father's time as well. So acts of forcibly disappearing, especially men who are of combat age, is routine and typical. I don't expect the Assad regime to put forth any legitimate or lasting ceasefire deals. I don't see them in the slightest being concerned about human life. So anything, any news that comes from the Assad regime, I would look at with incredible skepticism.
Right, but what then is their dependence upon Russia and Iran? Presumably, they were on the ropes before Russia and Iran moved in to rescue the Assad regime from defeat, or at least losing parts of Damascus. Since Russia's come in, obviously the military fortunes of the Assad regime have reversed. So what leverage does the Russians have over the Syrians? In other words, if the Russian general and Vitaly Churkin, their spokesman at the UN, is now saying we have a ceasefire deal, can the Russians be good to their word? Can they control the Assad murderers?
Well, I'm not sure if the Russians can control the Assad murderers. I'm not sure the Russians can control themselves. If you recall, and maybe your listeners will recall, just a few weeks ago, Russia said that it had suspended airstrikes, yet we were receiving daily reports about Russian airstrikes targeting schools and hospitals. In fact, the last hospital in Aleppo was hit repeatedly a couple of weeks ago. So I don't know that we can rely on words that are issued for public consumption. What we need to do is look at specific actions on the ground. And as long as civilians are being slaughtered by the Assad murderers under the cover of Russian aircraft, the words mean nothing.
Now, the people that are under siege, not just the civilians, but the fighters themselves, they've been characterized as the so-called moderate opposition or the Free Syrian Army. Is that accurate? Are there al-Nusra and other radical groups in there, or are these, because this has always been what I've understood to be the cynicism of the Assad regime, is that they've never really targeted the jihadis. They've used them as an excuse to say all people who oppose us are terrorists, and they've concentrated along with the Russians on going after the more moderate opposition of the Free Syrian Army. Is that in play now? Do they have the Free Syrian Army remnants under siege?
You're absolutely right, Ian. From the very beginning of the revolution in March of 2011, anybody that expressed opposition to the Assad regime was labeled a terrorist, whether that person was a nonviolent activist carrying signs in the streets, or somebody who eventually resorted to self-defense, or an army defector. All of us have been branded as terrorists, and so the Assad regime fails to differentiate between defected soldiers, between among civilians, and among ISIS fighters. Now, one of the very interesting and maddening elements of this conflict is that Assad and Russia and Iran have systematically targeted the more secular, moderate opposition in Syria rather than going after the real threat, which is Daesh or ISIS. And we also need to remember that the Syrian people have been fighting not only Assad, supported by Russia and Iran and Hezbollah, but also Daesh, because ultimately the people of Syria began this revolution so that we could replace the Assad regime with a democratic, secular state that was bound by the rule of law.
So in terms of your skepticism about this deal and about the Russians being good to their word, wasn't there, though, an earlier deal where rebel fighters or whatever you want to call them, were allowed out of a besieged area, and they came out with their light arms and were then trucked to rebel-held territory. In other words, the deal that we're told that the Turks and the Russians worked out is a safe passage corridor to Idlib. So are there precedents for this?
I don't think so. The people who were quote-unquote evacuated before, many of them, we don't know where they are. And so, no, I don't have any faith in deals like this. But let's say, for example, that this deal were to hold true and moderate so-called rebels or moderate fighters who are opposed to the Assad regime are trucked to Idlib. Let's assume that for a minute. What this does is it gives Assad his justifications for targeting Idlib next. And we're all expecting that. We're expecting a siege similar to what was imposed on Aleppo to be imposed on different parts of Idlib next.
So on the other side, though, the regime area, which was, as we mentioned earlier, was shrinking, and they were in danger of losing a big chunk of Damascus before the Russians stepped in and rescued the Assad regime. The areas that the Assad controls, mostly the Tartus and Latakia, I'm getting reports that the Alawites and the people that support this regime have demonstrated it at the many, many funerals that take place. And you know how tightly controlled Syria has always been under the Assads. They have more secret police than just about any per capita than any country on the face of the earth. The sort of mordant joke in Syria is the only time you open your mouth is when you go to the dentist. So it's been the Republic of Fear, even worse than Saddam Hussein's Iraq in terms of the Muhabarat, the secret police. But nevertheless, in spite of that oppression, my understanding is that even Alawites have been demonstrating at funerals against the government because these families have lost all of their sons. I mean, in other words, this war has also taken its toll on the regime fighters.
Absolutely. This issue has plagued, I would say, just about every Syrian family in Syria and abroad. Keep in mind, the soldiers that are fighting for the Syrian Arab Army are conscripts. It's not like they've signed up for this. Those in the Alawi community, one may have thought that they might be more supportive of an Alawi-led regime. But in fact, what these soldiers are seeing is that they're being forced to kill fellow Syrians. Many of the Alawi soldiers are coming home in body bags. So for an Alawi family, the point is not to protect the regime. The point is to protect their families and their fellow Syrians. There is tremendous discord within the Alawi community, and I would say that the support for Assad has declined considerably even in the last 3 years.
So let's assume then that with Iranian and Russian help that Assad declares some kind of victory. He'll obviously never control all of the territory, but he'll control the coastal areas. What kind of a viable regime could he have if there's so much discontent within his own ranks?
I don't think the Assad regime can ever have a viable state again. He can declare victory. They are in the process of declaring victory over Aleppo. Assad himself has vowed two things. One, he said, Assad, or we burn the country. And this has been implemented by his thugs throughout the nation. The other thing he said is that he will not stop until he recaptures every inch of Syrian territory. And I believe him. I believe that they mean it when they say, Assad, or we burn the country. I believe it when they say, submit or starve. We've seen that all over the nation. And I believe it when he says he will not stop until he has recaptured every inch of territory. But what he is not thinking about and what he's not considering is that now the Syrian people want him out. They want the Russians out. They want the Iranians out. The Syrian people want to return to a time of peace and stability that does not include the Assad regime.
Well, but what's left of the country and of the Syrian people? I mean, you've got I think a quarter to a third of the country displaced internally and externally, or maybe it's just even as high as a half. You've got probably 500,000 killed. God knows how many disappeared and wounded. What's going to be left? I mean, that's the sense I have, you know. And if there is this retribution, against the Sunni majority as in Aleppo and Idlib and whatever places that Assad takes, won't that create another refugee crisis?
Well, let's start with the numbers first. So right. By our calculations, we have more than 500,000 people killed. We have more than 250,000 people in forced detention. These are considered prisoners of conscience or political prisoners, and we don't know if they're dead or alive. In terms of the refugee crisis and the displacement crisis, more than half of the population of Syria, so that's well over 11 million people, are either refugees abroad or internally displaced. So the situation is absolutely catastrophic, and that's one reason why the UN called this the worst humanitarian disaster since World War II. So that's the first point I'd like to make. But the other point in to your question, what's left of Syria, is not a question that implies that Syrians have no choice but to accept a genocidal dictator as a leader. What it means is that whatever is left of Syria after this is over needs to be returned to the people, and the people who can and want to return to Syria will, and we have to begin the process of rebuilding. Now, in terms of retribution and transitional justice, there are a huge number of issues we're going to have to address in any foreseeable post-Assad phase. Even with a Assad government remaining in power, at least temporarily, we're still going to have those issues. And those are things we have to work out as citizens, as a community, and as a people.
But you'll have to have some kind of guarantor, because if the Russians and the Iranians and the Assad regime set the terms, then the majority of the people have no rights. They're completely vulnerable to retribution and slaughter. So who's going to step in and protect the Syrian people from Assad?
That's a really good question, because Western powers have failed to do exactly that. And for almost 6 years, we've been warning, I specifically have been warning, that this, in fact, is a Holocaust in Syria that's taking place. And up until now, those Western powers who have said they were supportive of the pro-democracy movement have not provided any cover or have not really taken any action that had teeth behind it. So now we're moving into another phase. We're going to have to see who will be the protector of these civilians, who will help rebuild the country, and what kinds of deals are going to be negotiated.
Well, Rafiq Shujadi, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Rafiq Shujadi, who's the founder and director of the Free Syria Foundation. She's also the English language spokeswoman for the local coordination committees in Syria, a grassroots network designed to align the activities of pro-democracy Syrians in each of the country's 14 governorates. Rafiq frequently travels to the Middle East and Syria. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.